morning, members. Today we'd like to bring the
Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. We have the minutes of last Thursday's meeting of March 10th. Representative Heinzman, you want to move the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Heinzman's moved the minutes. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Minutes are adopted. Today, members, we will have the DNR report definitions and thresholds for negative impacts to surface water. It's a report that's very important. We've asked the DNR to come forward, and I guess Mr. Meckel, Commissioner Meyer has decided to sit with you, okay? All right, good. And we can bomb both of you. No. Rest of the week, members, will include tomorrow is the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council bill, and that is mine and Representative Lilly's bill. And then on Thursday is Representative Hackbar's LCCMR bill. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thought we saw an email about amendments or a different time for amendments, and maybe just to announce that or... Oh, is it the same? 3 o'clock.
Members, the amendment timeline is 3 p.m. the day before, and then we will, small technical and oral amendments are in line also. So I guess historically, if you wanted to delete a project, I have considered that to be an oral amendment. So, I mean, just kind of where we're at. But it's nice if you do have amendments, it would be nice if we had them forward in time. They're due by 3. My anticipation is Ms. Sipko will try and have them posted by 4 or 5 that afternoon. So that's kind of where that's at. So that would be deadline 3 o'clock today for Lasard Sam's, and 3 o'clock the next day for LCCMR. Is that follower, Representative Hansen? Any questions on that, feel free to let us know. Anything else on either of those? I do anticipate that we'll do both of those bills on the day that they're before the committee, and it's my anticipation that we'll be able to get through the bill in the hearing time allowed. It's not my anticipation of needing to come back in the evening, and that would be my hope at this time that we don't need to do that. Seeing no other discussion, welcome, Commissioner, and Mr. Meckel, go ahead with your testimony. I'm not sure who's doing what, but we are looking forward. This is good information. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And I just wanted to kind of tee this up before I turn it over to Mr. Meckel. This is a report that was required of us through the legislature last year to ask us to look at groundwater appropriation levels in response to some of the local challenges that we're seeing in certain areas of the state with surface water and groundwater connections and appropriations to those waters. So what we did is we put together a group of pretty much all the stakeholders that we could think of and had a series of, 5 meetings that lasted sometimes all day. The group was so enthused they wanted to meet more rather than less. I think some staff were there and a lot of people following this issue. The report has been presented in several locations, including the Minnesota Irrigators Association and also at the DNR Roundtable, where we did some survey work and some questioning of people. And if we have time, we can get into those slides. But it does represent an area, a direction that we're interested in moving towards in appropriating water. However, at the last meeting where we were going through the recommendations, we discussed how to move the issue forward legislatively, and it was agreed that if anything was going to move forward, it would be through consensus and with a lot of discussion with the group. We haven't been there yet. We haven't been able to nail down the language and have those discussions. So if there is any desire to do something this session, which is such a complicated issue, I don't know if we have time to do. We would need to convene all of the stakeholders and interested parties to try to get some consensus as well. So, and Mr. Meckel will talk about some of those recommendations that we have. What we're trying to move to is rather than use these groundwater management areas, one of the concepts that we've discussed is developing an appropriation management area where we would try to identify the amount of water available, not at a watershed, but at almost a watershed level basis, and then appropriate from there. Minnesota isn't the... Western states water law. So, and we don't want to get to the point where it's last in, first out. So we're trying to figure out new and better ways to take the technology we have and appropriate water so that everybody can meet their needs, and we can make sure that we still have water available for the future. So one of those complicated issues we're trying to get our arms around.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. I just want to confirm, you said you don't want to get the last in, first out. But is it conceivable that some of Minnesota law really is last in, first out currently? Or do you want to, maybe you can touch on that, Mr. Meckel, if that makes sense as you do your presentation.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about that.
If you'd just be aware of that, I think as it is appropriate in your presentation, if you could mention, because I know Commissioner Meyer touched on some of the other different options that might work. So go ahead, identify yourself for the record.
Jason Meckel, Section Manager, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Good morning. Thank you for having us here today. As Commissioner Meyer said, you know, the reasons that we did this report were the legislation last year, but it really came down to what we've been learning over the last 5 years or so more intensively is the challenge of managing our groundwater resources and their relationship to surface waters, and trying to figure out how do we quantify that? How do we use that to actually set limits, very specific limits on appropriation permits? And we've run into some of these kinds of issues in a variety of places around the state. So what I'm going to cover is just a little bit of very brief context for how we use groundwater and what the trends have been. I'm going to talk a little bit about the stakeholder input process, and Bob has already mentioned that. And then I want to go to the statutes that were sort of the crux of why we were asked to do this report. And then I'm going to focus quite a bit on sort of a technical summary of the recommendations and what we ultimately lay down in the report and what we think makes sense for the state of Minnesota going forward. And then I've tried to work up an example of how we see this applying in a geographic area to a set of permits. And Chair McNamara, I think that'd be a good place for us to talk about some of these allocation questions that come up and what the current statutes and rules say. So we realize that we're using more groundwater on average over time, about 3 billion gallons more per year. If you look at the trend line there, it shows it's going up. Our use fluctuates on an annual basis, just really depending on what happens with Mother Nature. If it doesn't rain, our cities and our irrigators use more water than if it does. That's the main drivers of our use and consumption of groundwater. The other thing is that we are experiencing a significant increase in the number of new permit applications. 2013-2014 were an unprecedented number of new applications for appropriation permits in the state. Many of those, not all, but many, were for agricultural irrigation. This little video clip, which doesn't show up well on the sheets that you have, but this is an animation. It's showing you a timeline, 1988 till 2015, and it's just a measure of well density. It shows, you know, the number of wells that are requiring a permit concentrated in geographic areas of the state and how it's increasing over time. I think it does a nice job of giving a visual to the things I just showed. And what this really is showing us is that we are intensively using water in some places more than in others around the state. There are good reasons for that. I think we'd all recognize the metropolitan area, the I-94 growth corridor, using groundwater for largely municipal supplies, some agriculture, and particularly in Dakota County. And then the western, central, middle of the state, you know, those are largely sandy soils, and irrigation is essential to grow some of the crops that are grown in those parts of the state. So as Commissioner Meyer mentioned, we had this legislation that passed last year. We put together some technical teams to help us to work through the science. We assembled a project advisory team of stakeholders. That's the 25 different organizations that we specifically invited to make sure that they would be there. We opened these to the public so others could be there as well. As often as not, I would say we had as many public as we did actual invited guests at these meetings. We started out with the idea we'd have four and we'd meet for 2 hours at a time. After the first one, group said, you need more time and we need another meeting. So we stretched it out for 5 hours. We brought in some lunch and we did it for five meetings over the course of 5 months. Well, we didn't just use that process to engage stakeholders. I mentioned we had three technical teams we formed around streams, around lakes and wetlands. We had some interagency work groups that are part of clean water implementation. We consulted with them. I gave multiple presentations to the Minnesota Planning and Zoning, Minnesota Rural Water, League of Women Voters, a whole variety of organizations called and asked to, you know, learn more about this issue over the last 6 months. And we also used our website and our gov delivery system. And by the time we issued the report in January, we'd had over 400 subscribers that were getting updated bulletins. I think many of you might have been getting those as well. I know the Legislative Water Commission was had asked to be subscribed to that. We sent out a total of 9 bulletins. Everything that the group heard in those 5 meetings, we posted on our websites, the PowerPoints, and not just the slides, but the actual text, literally the speaker's notes, what the speaker said, so that as many people as wanted to could really follow along with the process. And then we had an email address that was right there on that page that said, if you want to comment or ask questions, you could do it that way. So that was the process. This is just what one of those messages looks like when it goes out. So I want to come back to statutes. The statutes say that we're responsible for allocating water and issuing permits to allocate to use water over 1 million gallons per year or 10,000 gallons per day. And when we issue those permits, when we establish those limits on those permits, we have to consider current projected water levels, water quality, protecting ecosystems, and future generations to meet their needs. So those are the things in a nutshell that we have to consider. We have to be sure that when we authorize water, that we're meeting those requirements. One of the specific statutes that raised the question and generated the desire for the report was 103G287 subdivision 2. This statute was changed in 2014 to read the way it reads on your screen right now. Groundwater appropriations that will have negative impacts to surface waters are subject to applicable provisions in 103G285. Prior to 2014, that said groundwater appropriations that have potential impacts to surface waters are subject. So we worked with this body in 14 to change it to negative to say, well, it's got to be something that's substantial that's going to actually impact the systems, not just the potential. But there were still questions and concerns about what did that mean, what was negative, and what was the number, right? Where did that happen? At what point? Surface water provisions do not allow us to issue a direct appropriation from a trout stream, from a pipe, directly out of the stream. It's prohibited. It can only be done if it's temporary, so like construction. You know, you need to dewater for a short period of time to do some construction, that sort of thing, as an example. Surface water provisions also say that we are only to appropriate the equivalent of 6 inches worth of volume off of any basin in the state. So it's a half an acre foot. You can figure out how many acres the lake has. That's your volume. That's what you can authorize to be taken via a pipe directly out of the water body. And then we'd need to set a protection elevation in doing that.
Representative Fabian has a question on this slide. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, the first line there, would you go through the change that was made, I believe you said in 13, change the to will, what was the word that was in there before?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I believe the what it read was groundwater appropriations that have potential impacts to surface waters. I might be missing a word, but I think that I'm pretty sure that that's what it said. It was that have the potential impacts to surface waters is the operative phrase.
Follow-up, Representative Fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the word will being inserted in there, how do you determine will have? In the lead-up to, you know, the different things that you do, what's the mechanism that you use to establish will have negative impacts?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I'm not sure if will was an insert. That's the one word I'm uncertain about, if that was inserted or not. Will have potential or not. But to answer your question in terms of will, if I understand what you're asking, that's what we use is groundwater models and other measurements of flow and other things. And actually, I'll talk quite a bit about that as I get farther into the presentation.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify then, I guess what I'm getting at is how do you determine, well, in this case here, now will have negative impacts before it read will have potential negative impacts. So this is kind of a definitive statement. So what I'm wondering about is what's the science that you use to determine will have negative impacts, whether when you make a decision to either approve or not approve an appropriation permit. And I'll be willing to listen to that answer later on in your presentation.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, just two questions here. One, about the trout streams. Number one, how come only temporary appropriations from trout streams, because trout streams obviously vary in terms of flow and everything else. And then how do you determine, from the DNR perspective, what a trout stream is? I mean, some streams may have just a few trout, some streams may be a viable trout fishery. How do you determine that? Those two questions, please.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the reason for temporary is that trout streams are more sensitive to changes in flow and particularly temperature. And as you remove water out of a system, it's more easily warmed, and temperature becomes a pretty critical issue for trout. It's in fact one of the most significant characteristics that distinguishes a trout stream from not a trout stream is the water temperatures that it gets to during the summer months. And it's that groundwater that comes in that's typically about 50 degrees that keeps it cold. And if you remove a lot of water during the summer months, the water gets lower, it warms up, it becomes critical, and the trout streams can be impacted. So that's a short answer to why they, you know, and this was done in 1977, so, but I think the science behind it hasn't changed, so I'm pretty sure that that's why that was implemented. As to how do we determine trout streams, several characteristics, one of which is primarily the water temperature. How warm does it get during the summer, and how cold does it get during the winter? During the summer months, trout streams don't do well if they get above 75 degrees or even 77 degrees, and especially if they're going to stay there for a very long period of time. Trout can adapt for a few hours, but they will literally roll over if they're above 77 for more than a very brief amount of time. Typically, we look at about 68, 70 degrees is kind of where your trout streams would top out. Some won't even ever get that high if they're really, really heavily connected to groundwater. Lots of springs, really flowing steady. Then they don't even typically get that warm. But they also don't typically freeze over extensively in the winter. Some parts will freeze, but they typically don't freeze solid in the winter because that's when their eggs are in the stream bed and they're developing and they hatch in the spring. So the winter groundwater is just as important as the summer groundwater. There's other characteristics about the stream bottom, the, you know, what kind of insect community and other fish species are present that factor into it. But water temperature tends to be a major deciding factor.
Follow-up, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often do you do trout population studies? When you've designated something as a trout stream, obviously times and conditions change. Something that was designated as a trout stream in the 70s may not be a trout stream today with a viable population, but yet it's still designated that. How often do you look at that, possibly change designations?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, about every 3 years, the Section of Fisheries does some review of its designations. Historically, they've looked at that as what are some places that we've missed that probably are supporting trout or that we now know do, and they've added. They've initiated a process to review all of the designated trout streams to determine if there are any that are no longer or maybe never were or very good, and they've got a list generated of those streams and are working through a process to put those out for public comment and then potentially undesignate them as trout streams. But it's not a regular and common, pursuit. In terms of how often do we check the streams themselves for trout, it varies a lot depending on where you are in the state. Southeastern Minnesota and the North Shore have a lot of trout streams. Those are the primary angling opportunities. That's the focus of the resource management for those fisheries management offices primarily. And they go out and they'll survey those streams more frequently than some of the other streams in some of the parts of the state where lakes are the more prominent recreational feature and the staffing resources. They don't get to those trout streams as often. They still do, but typically not as often. But it's highly variable. What they'll do is say, this stream has been great for a really long time. We probably don't need to revisit it very often. Prioritize this one. Maybe we need to learn some more about it. Let's put some energy over there. So there's just not a single answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, thank you for coming down. I've been to some of your some of the meetings that you've had, and the turnout, you are correct, was good indeed. I have a couple of quick questions for you. One, segueing into what you were just saying here, when will, you said that a list of trout streams is being put together as we speak, and they're going to be looking at the designations for these trout streams. When do you anticipate that that list will be released?
Mr. Meyer, would it be possible, why don't you get us that information? I was thinking that I had recently seen from the department some proposed changes, and I can't remember in the last year, but how about if you get us the information on, why don't you also have us, somebody send us the process for adding them, delisting them, and then what's been happening in the last couple of years. I think those are good questions. A little background information would be good for us to have. Representative Neuberger, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, at this time, to your knowledge, this is something that has come up on a frequent basis in my district. When you put that map up there, it was my district, okay, for irrigation. At this time, to your knowledge, currently, are there any dry drainage ditches that would be classified as trout streams according to your maps?
Mr. McElard, Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberg, I'm not familiar with the map of the designated trout streams in that area, but I can tell you that trout stream designations has a bit of a complicated history as well that has to do with the way they get mapped. And the way it works is that if the stream in a given section is designated, then any of the tributaries that flow into it are called designated tributaries. So oftentimes what happens is the stream, and I could give you a good example, Representative McNamara's district, the Vermilion River is a designated trout stream, but there's a drainage ditch that comes in, and a portion of it is a designated tributary because of the way the law reads, it's by section. You designate the waters in that section. And that was, I can't remember the date now, there was a whole lawsuit around that and legal battle a number of years ago now, I guess 20 years ago or so.
Follow up, Representative Neuberger.
No, I'm good for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, what's the threshold? I mean, how, in terms of the number of trout that are in a stream and so forth, how does it become designated as a trout stream? Based on numbers, just the conditions, the potential? Help me with that.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, there's no magic number. Small streams will have a smaller population, large streams a larger population. It really comes down to, are there trout present more than three or two or five? Or are the conditions such that we believe that trout would survive there, maybe had historically been there, had been extirpated for a variety of reasons, and that a stocking program could reestablish the population. I mean, you go back in history in terms of how some of these streams came about to be trout streams. We don't have perfect records of whether or not all these things were trout streams in the 1850s. But as we managed resources around the state, you know, stocking programs tried a variety. We've tried salmon in southeastern Minnesota at one point in time. People thought it was a good idea to try it. It didn't work. You know, the brook trout in southeastern Minnesota largely suffered A lot of degraded stream channels, a lot of bad history with erosion and channel problems. And brook trout have returned in large part, but brown trout were stocked because they could tolerate those conditions better, and now we've got a combination of brown trout and brook trout. But there is no specific number other than the conditions I described earlier in terms of water temperature, the kind of species, insects, stability of the flow. You know, there's about five or six kind of key things that we look at.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, so then is it safe to say or assume that there are streams in the state of Minnesota that do have trout in them that are not designated the trout stream? And by the same token, is it safe to say or to assume that there are streams that are designated trout streams that don't have trout in them?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes and yes.
And Mr. Meckel, that's true in the Vermilion River you alluded to. The Vermilion River, once you get downriver of Highway 52, is not designated a trout stream, but trout have now migrated farther south as conditions have gotten better with some of the conditions. And Representative Fabian, they are catching trout downstream of Highway 52, though it's not designated yet, because I don't think it meets the water temperature. So the fish need to move upstream where the water is colder, closer to the source of the springs. Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, I'll expand on my yes and yes. The Root River is another example. You know, the Root River itself, as you get down farther past the South Branch, etc., it's not designated, but there's trout in it. And seasonally, when the temperatures are not hot, they tend to go down there and forage. And the Vermilion River, as Representative McNamara said, these systems don't have, unless there's dams, they don't have hard walls that prevent these fish from moving. These fish will move around and use these other channels and other situations seasonally. I've personally tracked fish with radio telemetries on the Vermilion River. I know very well how far they can move and how short a time they can move. Very long distances, just depending on the conditions.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Meckel, and Representative Meyer. I'm just trying to put this into plain language, but water still flows downhill, right? That law hasn't been changed or hasn't been modified. Or if you've got a tributary, it flows down into the larger body and then keeps moving. But groundwater does not flow based on the topography above it. That the stream could be moving one way, but the groundwater flow could be in a different way. Could you give any examples of that, or how that happens, or what happens there?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, sure. I'll give you an example. Let's use Dakota County. The geology around Dakota County and the Vermilion River is such that in the western part of the county, Lakeville, Farmington, Empire Township, the groundwater is upwelling and it's flowing towards the stream. All of the aquifers there have a positive head. They're moving towards, the groundwater is flowing towards the stream. As you get on the other side of 52, Highway 52, the geology, the underlying geology changes. It's the soils on the top also change. There aren't any more tributaries that really flow into the river at that point once you get to the east. And depending on groundwater levels, there's times when the river is literally just losing water very slowly to the surrounding water table aquifer versus just a few miles to the west that water's flowing into the river. So that's one example. Now that can be a seasonal thing. That can be a long-term thing. It can be, you know, in any given geology. In southeastern Minnesota, we have places where the stream will literally disappear for a while and then come back because of the underlying geology. Very complex.
Follow up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meckel, I think you might have been in your previous position when in Dakota County with Lake Bilsby, when the dam was up or raising the head on the dam, that some of the surrounding landowners were impacted because the saturation moved out into those farms. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you remember that, or I can remember visiting a basement where the water was running through the cracks, and it was probably about 2 miles from the Bilsby Dam because of the saturation in that shallow sands. And then they changed the dam, and the water flow went down. But do you remember that, or
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have detailed knowledge of that situation. I've heard bits and pieces, but I wouldn't offer any testimony on it.
Well, I think, Representative Hansen, the way I remember it, there was a movement, and I can't remember by who, but to increase the level of water behind the dam, and it had significant impacts to people's homes and farmland and such out and around the lake. It was amazing how it didn't seem like a very big movement, and I think it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was driven by recreation purposes, the thought that more water would be better, if I'm remembering it correctly. It was long before my days here. Additional follow-up, Representative Hansen. Representative Purcell, did I see your hand come up? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be remiss if I just want to add into the trout stream discussion here how important vegetation is along the bank of the trout stream. I you know, we've got our wonderful little Bungashane Creek up there and south of Bemidji, and you got to have vegetation to keep that water temp down in the summer. You really do. So it takes an ecosystem to make a trout stream.
Additional comments? No, we're good to go. You're back on track. Proceed, Mr. Meckel.
Well, to Representative Fabian's question about how do we figure out impacts, that was the focus of the report and the technical work that we did and the discussions that we had. And I've got a series of slides that I'm going to walk you through here. This first one, if you picture this graph on the left-hand side as being January and the right-hand side being December, and the vertical axis is just a hypothetical sort of flow or water level in a river. So typically in Minnesota, what we see is a spring rise in our rivers, followed by a gradual summer decline, and then typically we get our low flows late summer into fall. There are exceptions, and I can show examples of that. And so this represents sort of the baseline condition, as Representative Purcell was talking about, that has shaped that ecosystem. This pattern of flow is why the kinds of fish species and community exist and why the stream looks the way it does. Nationwide research, people, you know, folks that have been looking at this issue with dams and all kinds of other ways of altering flows have published numerous research articles that we've looked at and recognized that if we alter those stream flows at a given point, you know, at some location in that system by 20%, we are going to have negative impacts. We start to lose species from those streams, the more sensitive species. It can be combinations of fish species, it can be insect species, it could be other species. That research also suggests that about 10%, we really don't detect and really don't expect to see much of a significant change in those ecosystems. So this was the national research that we used to help us then think about how do we apply this to the state of Minnesota, and what kind of systems do we have, and how do they, what sort of a flow, and they kind of match this flow. And ultimately, that's what we landed on as our recommendation in this report, is that we allow the uses to divert up to 10% of that stream's median low flow in August. I'm going to walk through some example, because as we've talked about this with other organizations, this has been one of the more difficult things to follow and understand, and I'm trying to get better at explaining it because it's complicated. And I'm going to have some examples further into the presentation where I'll show you how this would play out sort of from a math point of view, okay? But 10% is what we're recommending. We said in the report that in some situations and in some locations, it might make sense to even go as high as 15%. An example might be if you're a municipality and your water use during the summer months is a large fraction of it for lawn irrigation, fairly discretionary, considered non-essential by statute, maybe you're willing to tolerate that in some really dry times, you just tell your residents, we have to use less water because it's really dry. and we can allow a sort of 15% threshold, if you will. But I don't think that that's going to work very well in an agricultural setting or in a situation where you've got an industry. When agriculture needs water during the summer because it hasn't rained for a few weeks or a couple of weeks or even a week, having the, well, you know, we can get by with less doesn't seem to work. And we were at the Irrigation Association's annual meeting here a few weeks ago and asked very specific questions of the group with little clickers to get their sense of things. And it was very clear that they strongly preferred stability over variability depending on what the climate's doing because of the nature of their business. And I think an industry would be the same way. If I've got an industrial process that relies on a certain amount of water, I need to know that I can count on it each and every month. If I've got contracts, I'm delivering, in the case of Cold Spring, I've got beverage contracts, I'm delivering those. I need to know that I can plan for that when I take those contracts. But I think in our municipalities, we have more flexibility because of the non-essential use component. All right. So what we're talking about here is a stream that in 1 year, 7,000 gallons, okay, I put this into gallons, per second flowing through this spot. Same stream, different time, 1 gallon per second flowing through the spot. I can tell you that's not a trout stream. I don't even know what stream it is. I get the pictures from my staff, but I know it's not a trout stream because trout streams don't experience that kind of extreme low flows very often at all. But what we've attempted to do here is to say, how can we allow some use of water but prevent us from having streams go lower than they would otherwise go, more often than they would otherwise go there, such that they no longer then support the same fish community, the same insect community, the same riparian vegetation, the same water quality. The report also looked at lakes. Did you want to?
Representative Hornstein.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. This conversation about water levels, and I think you referenced droughts, et cetera. Did your report make any linkages between some of these trends and climate change as well? Did that come up in your conversations?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the question about how to deal with climate change came up a number of times in the meetings and the discussions. We did not address it in the report, largely because while there are models that predict that we're going to see changes in our precipitation patterns, the models haven't been downscaled enough that we could apply them to any particular geography or any particular stream in a way where we could say, here's what we think might happen, and then we could back that up and say, okay, well, this is how we would interpret that. So we're just not at that stage yet to be able to do that.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that in different areas and other studies that the agency has done on resilience, et cetera, you have looked at some of these factors related to climate. Do you anticipate, you know, down the road doing that? You said maybe at this particular stage in this particular report you didn't do that, but is there a thought about, looking at some of that data in the near future?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm aware of some proposals, and I think they might be coming to the LCCMR for some of the work that would set the foundation to be able to do that. So there are conversations among our agency partners to try to advance that science. I don't know specific timelines, but I think there's some projects that are working in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on Representative Hornstein, if the new normal is unpredictability, wouldn't we want to be erring on the side of caution?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we talked about that, and and our state climatologist in our meeting, said our crystal balls are foggy. The best we've got is the record that we've got, and we can manage according to that and then adapt over time. But to your point, we feel that 10% is a reasonable threshold. Trying to go all the way to 20 and saying we're going to stop right here, right at that, quote-unquote negative point, when there is that uncertainty, didn't make sense to us. unless we get into a specific situation where, for whatever reason, you know, we evaluate it and we think it does. But we believe 10% was a reasonable approach to the question.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, you mentioned Cold Spring. I see Representative Howe is here today. I know that he has been very concerned about what's going on at Cold Spring. What are you doing to work with them to, you know, you talked about contracts and delivery and so forth. What is DNR doing to work with Cold Spring to ensure that they can continue to deliver their contracts and do things in a reasonable way?
Is this Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I can describe generally, you know, what's happening. It's been sort of changing by the week in terms of the specifics there, but we worked with the brewery to give them some time, along with the city, to figure out alternative sources of water because their pumping is really close to the trout stream, and we've been able to show the impacts of the pumping to flow in the stream. We extended a permit, and we've been working with them to help the city find an alternative water supply. They're challenged with nitrate levels in their existing well system. They've identified another location. They've done some test wells. We've reviewed that information. It looks favorable. We're trying to advance that further, and the city's trying to pursue, I think, some bonding support to develop that new well field to meet the municipal supply, with the idea that then their existing well field, which is considerably farther away from the stream, less impact on the stream, could be used to meet the brewery's beverage and business. And those situations have been sort of dynamic. The brewery's trying to figure out their business model. The city's trying to figure out where they go. And we've been having regular meetings with them to try to support those efforts and move in that direction. You know, there might be more specific details, but that's what I know of the situation, the most recent.
And Mr. Meckel, isn't part of that discussion the fact that the brewery, for some of their products, the high nitrate level is okay with them, so there's some working with the different needs where the high nitrates for normal wells would in city use needs to be below that 10 number for sure for pregnant women and young children. Some of the products the brewery makes, the nitrates are not a problem in their processes. And so I appreciate the department's work in this. I know it's a tough situation. It's a great city, a great employer, and a terrific trout stream there. So thank you for continuing. Representative Fabian, or do you want to go comment first, Mr. Meckel, then we'll follow up from Representative Fabian. Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Meyer reminded me, we also instrumented the stream with continuous flow monitoring a year and a half or so ago, and we've instrumented some wells out there to better understand the situation. The long-term solution that the brewery is pursuing is to maintain their malted beverage business down by the stream and move their the energy drink business or whatever I think it is farther away. And what we're trying to figure out is there an amount of water that the brewery could depend on down still by the creek at their current location? And we've implemented all these monitoring systems out there to get us to a place where we can give them some certainty. We told them there was that the number that they had number of years ago we thought was reasonable based on our models, and they're looking at possibly increases to that, and that's where some of the uncertainty has come in because we just don't know yet.
And when you talk about moving, you're talking about moving the water supply, not the physical manufacturing plant.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that they're actually looking to expand, and so they are thinking about building a new facility up near that other water supply. So it's a both.
Well, I was not aware of that. Okay, cool.
And I might not have that all perfect, because like I said, it's been dynamic.
You're not working for Deed or whoever, you're working for DNR.
No.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick follow-up. Mr. Meckel, you said you've given them some time. I'm wondering how much time have you given them?
Mr. Meckel, do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I think a year and a half ago or so, we gave them through 2017 on their limited permit, and we've said all along, as long as we're making progress, things are moving towards a solution, we'll continue to work with them. Right now, I think it's a crunch issue between the city getting a new supply their business. It's just largely a timing constraint that's factoring in here, but not the permit. We're working with them to help them get where they need to be.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get into too much stuff here today, but because I know you have a presentation to make, but we talked a little bit about climate. Overall, isn't it true that in general in Minnesota we're seeing additional rainfall, an increase in rainfall in general terms over time?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the last 20 years, according to the climate records available through the Climatology Office and NOAA, do indicate that the last 20 years have been wetter than normal as a state. There are pockets and places where that's not entirely true, and you know, with years within, but the last 20 years have been above average, normal being the average for the 30-year period.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Also, you know, we talk about these extreme years, and I think back to 1988 on my farm when the North Fork of the Watonwan River dried up. I drove my tractor down the bed of the river because I could. I don't know why I did that. I don't remember, but
get a permit?
Because I could, I guess. Because then I could bring it up at this hearing, I think, is why I did it. You know, we've had extreme variations in our climate over time. You know, and you have a huge challenge of trying to decipher at what point is the impact of our human activity actually impacting these cycles, because these things do cycle naturally. I, for one, think your 10% is overly aggressive. The Watonwan River dried up, and it filled back up again, and, you know, nature has a way of recovering whether we are involved or not, and so trying to identify an appropriate limitation on our activities is a huge challenge, and I know you're working on it. I just personally feel you're being a little aggressive.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, going back to the situation in Cold Spring, I just wanted to quick ask. It sounded like you had mentioned that there was some modeling on the Cold Spring stream. Is that available?
Mr. Meckel, why don't you, Mr. Meyer, put some information together on the Cold Spring Brewery, the Root River? Do I have the right river or wrong river? The name of the river is?
Cold Spring.
Oh, sorry. I don't need to get... Thank you. That makes sense, doesn't it? Sorry, Representative Howell. Why don't you put some information that you feel comfortable with us providing, and is there an answer to Representative Heinzman's specific question?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've been monitoring for the last year and a half continuously flow levels. There's some historic data that we've looked at that matches with that, but we have not developed a complex groundwater model yet. We really need a little bit more information to develop one that would be meaningful. We have done some simple modeling. I will, a little farther into the presentation, I'm going to illustrate sort of the complexity and the need for complex versus simple situations and why that's the case. So we did some modeling, and it gives us a sense of what the impact is, but I can't tell you that that's the number, that's the actual impact, because it's just a simple approach. We need to do a more complicated approach to get at that.
Thank you. A follow-up, Representative Heinzman?
So just to be clear, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meckel, will that information be included in that discussion or that information that we just requested for the Cold Spring stream?
Yes, it would, to the point that I want to be careful that we don't put out any proprietary or, you know, there's negotiations maybe between the brewery and the city on who's going to pay for what, and I don't think Mr. Meckel's, that's why I wanted to give them an opportunity. It'd be good to have more information about that, because it is a complex and tough issue, and I don't know if anybody has said, but it is on a designated trout stream.
Yes.
So that's got those complications of the stream as a designated trout stream. I think we'll take one more question on this specific slide, Mr. Meckel, from Representative Hansen. And then I think, unless folks have a real clarifying question, why don't we be sure we get through this within, say, the next half hour, Mr. Meckel, for sure, because I know there's at least a couple people that want to testify, and then I know there's other people interested in it from different interests, from the trout, from different interest groups. If any of those want to testify, if you could let the pages know, so we're sure that anybody wants to testify today gets an opportunity, and then that'll tell us when you need to get done also, Mr. Meckel. But Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, I think there may be greater rainfall, but you get it in more extreme events. So the unpredictability, the variability has higher peaks and valleys, and so that can lead to more impacts. To this slide and the aquatic vegetation, I know when you do wetland determinations, you look at the plant life and how what types of plants can survive underwater for certain times, and there's a whole scientific strata of trying to determine using the biology. Maybe you could just describe that and the research or some of the science that's involved in that you use in a variety of determining matters.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I've got some wetlands slides in here. I think that'd be a slightly better place to try to talk to that point, and I'll do the best I can.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't you continue on?
So the statutes also say that if we appropriate water from lakes directly, if there was surface water, we have to set a protection elevation. And we have to consider the aquatic vegetation and habitat of that basin. What are the riparian uses? The total volume and slope of the shoreline. And I use this picture to illustrate that in our review of lakes of Minnesota and the various hydrology and how they go up and down, and you know, you'd think a lake is a lake is a lake, but they are quite different. And I'll talk about that. But the slope of the shoreline really does dictate how much a small or a large change is going to impact the riparian uses and the aquatic vegetation, right? So these things all interact. When we've got shallow, gradual shorelines like this, the lake goes down a foot or foot and a half, pretty significant impact here. You know, you can see the dock extensions, etc. On the other hand, lakes also need to fluctuate. You know, we've tried to manage lakes like a bathtub in large part in this state. We've tried to stabilize levels. We don't like them to get too low. We don't like them to get too high. We outlet them. We put in structures. That's our history. But lakes need to fluctuate. The shoreline vegetation that grows here because the water level is not static. It goes up and down. That vegetation doesn't grow if it doesn't once in a while get a little dry in those areas. And it depends on the type of vegetation and the type of lake. My point is, with 11,000 plus lakes in the state, we've got a lot of variety. But we've tried to look through a lot of the lake data that we have and categorize our lakes to help us to think about which of these lakes are going to even be vulnerable to a groundwater appropriation in its vicinity. Okay? And that's what this next slide illustrates. So lakes that have a frequent surface outflow. So picture lakes that you know, there's a river coming into it and there's a river going out of it. And it's flowing almost all the time. Okay? Those systems don't tend to fluctuate a lot. They'll bounce up or down a foot, foot and a half, 2 feet maybe, depending on the spring and how wet it is or how dry it gets. But they tend to outflow a lot. And if they're deep, they're not going to be very vulnerable to groundwater appropriations in the area. Now, it depends on how much the appropriation is, but generally speaking, not real vulnerable. On the other hand, if they're real shallow, we think there is some moderate vulnerability in a system like that. If you contrast that to lakes that infrequently outflow, you know, like it once in a while somebody's seen the water go out, you know, or maybe it goes out 5 years out of 10 or 3 years out of 10 or once out of 10, that kind of thing, but not as a regular thing. Whether it's shallow or deep, they're going to be more vulnerable, and it's just a simple budget, right? And I'll use a bank account as an analogy. If I've got money coming in, I got money going out, you know, as long as I'm keeping those things close, my balance stays pretty good. If I don't have a lot coming in and I start pulling more out, I'm at risk of dropping my balance, okay? And if it doesn't rain on these shallow, infrequent surface outflow lakes, they fluctuate more. They have more what we call bounce. They go lower, but they also go higher because they don't typically have a lot of outflow. So we've been looking at lakes around the state to try to figure out which of the lakes that we have in the state have this highest and high vulnerability, and where are they, and how would we approach dealing with these issues. And the report talks a little bit about this, that these tend to be smaller basins. They tend to be in west central Minnesota, but also places in some cases where there's a lot of irrigation in other or pumping. In other places, there just isn't a lot of groundwater pumping, and there isn't a lot of irrigation, and there aren't large municipalities, and we really don't see a lot of vulnerability. So what I'm trying to paint a picture here is that we have some places where this is going to be a concern, but we also have a lot of places where we probably don't have to worry too much. And in fact, there are probably some places in the state where we could develop and use more water than we currently do. We don't have that map produced. That's another one of these things we'd like to get to, is to try to figure out where are the opportunities. Right now, we're chasing some of the problems. We'd like to get to the place where we can develop the map of opportunity. And Chair, you mentioned DEED. They're very interested in that map. They've asked for it, and we wish we could give it to them. So I want to talk a little bit about wetlands. As much variety as we have in our trout streams, there's more in wetlands. You know, you look at wetlands, and you got wetlands that if you walked out there, it'd be squishy, but you wouldn't really be in water. On the other hand, you got floodplain wetlands that seasonally are inundated, and everything in between. And if you look at those wetlands, they have these sort of typical hydrographs. So this is the sort of water cycle that these features will experience, okay? So a floodplain forest, it's going to get real wet in March and April, right? The rains we're getting now, we're going to see those floodplain forests get wet, and then they'll start to dry out as the season goes. If you look at the opposite end of that spectrum, you look at this purple line, the sloped rich fen, that's the one on your black and white that just barely wiggles at all. Those are systems that are really driven by regional groundwater systems. They're very stable. There's very little change over time, very little change seasonally, and it's this groundwater upwelling in these places that maintains that community of plants, the chemistry, the microclimate, all the animals. It's those characteristics that shape why that system is what that system is. And then we get things in between, depressional marshes, or permanent, semi-permanent depressional marshes. So, Representative Hansen, you were talking about, you know, with wetland types. So it all comes down to what's the hydrology of the site, what are the soils of the site, what are the plants on that site. From that, we can determine and kind of categorize ones that are going to be more vulnerable, ones that are going to be less vulnerable. In the approach that we're suggesting to be developed for the state is that we develop a target hydrograph that we say, hey, as long as we manage in this way, we think that wetland has a real good chance of staying the way it is, being the characteristic. Some use, but not too much. And we don't have this kind of data developed for a lot of wetlands in the state. We're working on a project with some federal funding to enhance our monitoring, and we're trying to scrape together some funds to do some additional monitoring along with that to begin to develop these kinds of hydrographs around wetlands to help us better know where the target should be. Staying in the green, maybe occasionally in the yellow, but not the red. You go to the red, you change it. It shrinks. The vegetation changes. And these changes can happen very quickly. And once you degrade some of these wetlands, the time and expense to get them back, reed canaries establishes once it gets dry enough, it's really tough to get rid of it. And I'm not a wetland scientist, and you know, the trout stuff I've worked a lot with, the wetland stuff is not my thing, but this is what the technical committee that we pulled together of agency experts and folks from the university and outside consultants thought made the most sense for Minnesota based on the science around wetlands that we have. So our challenge then is we take the threshold for the stream or the threshold for the lake or the hydrograph for these wetlands, and we have to translate that into a volume of water that we can allow to be withdrawn. I told you, allow 10% of the stream's flow to be diverted for human use. That's not the same as how much water can we authorize to be pumped, because it's not a one-to-one relationship. It's groundwater. We can pump more groundwater than if you took it directly from the stream because it's a distributed effect. But we have to figure this out both at the individual permit level but also cumulatively because these things stack together and it's groundwater, so it's not just one spot. And what the report talks about is we're calling that, and what we're suggesting is that we establish these things called the sustainable diversion limit. This is how much we can plan on. This is what we can rely on. This is what we can build our economies and businesses to use. The sustainable diversion limit. So the methodology, our approach to this is it needs to be quantifiable. It can't be just, we think. But it needs to also be reasonably quick. Now, we get permits. We have a goal of responding to those permits within 150 days. Developing a complex groundwater model is not feasible within 150 days. But when we develop these models in given geographies, we can use those models to answer the questions that come forward so that we don't have to build a new model every new permit, right? That would be unfeasible. That wouldn't be a workable system. We think that the science that we've used to come up with the approach to these thresholds for streams, lakes, and wetlands is technically sound. We think the groundwater models are technically sound. They're used around the country. They've been developed, vetted by the USGS. They support those groundwater models, the ones that we're proposing to use here. We have to make sure that we account for this cumulative use. That's where the real challenge is. But we also think they're going to have to be predictive. We can't wait till we have all of the information. We're not going to have perfect information. And what we've said all along is that let's predict it to the best of our ability, monitor, and then adapt if we learn something new along the way. For the sake of argument, maybe it's a five-year sort of deal. You know, you plan to go this way for 5 years, you revisit the information, and then you make a change if necessary. We've heard of examples of how they do that in Nebraska. They have the natural resource districts out there. They manage the irrigation and appropriations. They manage it in five-year chunks. They set a water level goal. They allow a certain amount of appropriation. They revisit after 5 years, did we achieve our goal? What's the direction? And then they have a conversation about making adjustments if needed. We've talked with the Irrigation Association. We've talked with the irrigators. That seems to be an approach that makes a lot of sense to them so that you have some level of predictability and certainty for a period of time, and then we adapt as we go. I just want to illustrate the challenge of aquifers. It's what you don't see that's interacting with those surface water features. Here's the situation, right? I've got a water table aquifer. I got a layer of material that doesn't, you know, water doesn't move readily through it. It'll move through it. It's an aquitard. It's not an impermeable permanent boundary. And then you've got this confined aquifer underneath. Well, 150 feet of water table doesn't mean I can pump 150 feet. It's the first few inches, the first feet, that are actually in contact with that wetland, that stream, or that lake. So if I draw the water table down a foot, and that cone of depression reaches the stream, I'm impacting the flow of that stream. Well, maybe a little bit's okay. That's, you know, sort of the 10%. But if we keep going and we draw the water table down because we got 150 feet, we won't have these surface water features. We're not at risk of doing that, at least not yet. So the report has some recommendations for some definitions. We've kind of talked about these, but I'll go through them. We're suggesting that we define the negative impact, that place, that target, that thing that we establish as a change in hydrology that's sufficient to cause an ecosystem harm or alter riparian uses. We're not suggesting that it makes sense that we go harm the ecosystem, figure out how much it took to get there, and then we try to back off. It's what we predict will cause the ecosystem harm based on the threshold science that we've presented. Or alter those uses, those long-term riparian uses. Water levels go up and down. Maybe this year you push your dock out a little farther. But if you have to keep pushing your dock out every year, year after year after year after year, or the boat access is no longer an access, it's a canoe launch because you can't put boats in it, you've impacted riparian uses. Those are some examples, right? I'm just trying to illustrate. So when we were talking with our group, they said, okay, well, yeah, but what's ecosystem harm mean? We said, well, it's a change in the biological community and ecology that results in a less desirable or degraded condition. So it's not the same. We've lost species. It won't be same. When I say same, I don't mean exact, right? I mean, look, we're changing. We manipulate the biology. That's what we do. Everything we do, whether it's deer management, pheasants, ducks, whatever, walleye, we're manipulating these systems. But what we're talking about here is you're changing a system from it was a trout stream, now it's not a trout stream, or it's not a very good one. Or it used to be a smallmouth bass fishery, and now it's white suckers and carp. Okay? Just to draw a picture. And we think that establishing a sustainable diversion limit is the way to do this. It's the maximum amount of water that can be removed either directly or indirectly from a surface water, because we still have surface water appropriations in this state. They're not all groundwater. So we have to consider that. They got to be considered together. Within a geographic area on an annual basis that won't cause that negative impact. That's what we're suggesting as the approach for the state. So what is... the other recommendation, sorry, and then I'll get to how this plays out. The other recommendation that we have is that the statutes are constructed right now that you have surface water appropriations and you have groundwater appropriations. They have the same goal, right? Manage the system sustainably. They differentiate where the water, where the pipe is. From our point of view, where the pipe is not really what should establish whether or not it's an appropriation we should allow. It's whether or not it's going to have an impact or not. And we think it makes some sense to streamline. We can reduce the thickness of the statute book by a page and a quarter if we combine these things. You know, it's a small step, but we can do it. I do want to illustrate and make a very... And this is a really, really important point that we spend quite a bit of time on in those 25 hours of meeting time. The threshold is the point at which a negative impacts occur. What we've recommended is... How do we approach setting thresholds to avoid negative impacts, right? Not where the negative impact occurs, but how do we avoid the negative impacts? That's the 10%. That's the hydrologic regime for wetlands. That's the protection elevation that we manage for. It's not a single number. It's not a percentage that you say is we apply it everywhere around the state. It's what is needed for that system to maintain the variability in the natural seasonal hydrograph so that we maintain that system. It protects against regular, periodically occurring droughts. Representative Torkelson talked about, you know, extreme droughts and sometimes the less extreme droughts. We think this is a system that works most of the time. 1930s, all bets are off. We're going to have to make some adjustments if we go through another cycle like that. We won't be able to have green lawns in the 2000s if we get into a 1930s drought. We're going to have to make some changes. But most of the time, we think this kind of a system is a workable system for managing our appropriations in the state of Minnesota. All right. So as we've looked at how are we going to apply this, what our approach to this as an agency is, focusing on the areas of intense use, that map I showed you earlier, or the areas of the state that just have very limited aquifers and we're experiencing localized problems, well interference issues, problems with water supplies. Southwestern Minnesota tends to have pockets of these kinds of issues because of their aquifers. We will establish protected flows and protection elevations in these areas based on the data and analysis that we conduct. We use that to then determine the sustainable diversion limit. Then we review and revise permits to make sure we're staying in within those limits. And I'm going to talk about the math of how we get there, okay? So the process of how we think we get there, and then I'm pretty close to wrapping it up. And then if we get a situation where there's not enough water to meet all the demands, then we have an allocation question where we have to allocate according to statutory priority. Non-essential uses don't get the water in that scenario, right? That's car washes, lawn watering, that sort of thing, and you work your way up through the priorities. So let's use a hypothetical example. The work group that we had felt this really helped them understand the concept in sort of practicality. This red line represents what we call a hydrogeologically related neighborhood. Let's just say it's connected because of the groundwater underneath it's connected. Inside that boundary, if you pump, that's groundwater that would otherwise flow into one of those features on the map, okay? We've got a hypothetical wetland here. We've got a stream. We've got a lake. I've got a little box down there where that stream meets that river, and I've got just a measurement from our data that says the August median low flow is 10 cubic feet per second for that stream. That'd be the equivalent of about 4,500 gallons of water. Okay? So that's kind of what the normal low flow would be in that system. So what we'd do is we'd look at that low flow, and then you'd say, well, the normal range for that stream is some years it's 5, some years maybe it's 15, you know, and even in a really wet storm you might get a real big event, but those are pretty rare. So the normal range might be 5 to 15. The sustainable diversion limit is 10%. That allows us to have an impact of 1 CFS, an impact of 1 CFS on that system. That's 450 gallons a minute. Then we'd use a groundwater model of all the appropriations in that neighborhood to figure out when they pump at what gallons per minute over the course of the season is going to result in 1 CFS, or one in that stream in that location. Then what we're saying is the new normal for that stream in that spot is that, well, that normal low might go to 4, and maybe not to 15, but to 14. But we think that system will continue to support its ecology. Now, groundwater models have to take this kind of a complicated scenario, because in the state of Minnesota, we're not pumping from usually one aquifer, we're pumping from multiple aquifers. They interact in complicated ways. Distance away from the water body matters. So as you look at this graphic, the pumps that are demonstrated, or the wells on the far left of that graphic, are having less of an effect overall on that stream that's on the far right, lake or wetland, whatever you want it to be. The pumps that are pumping from that yellow confining unit are likely having less of an effect than the ones that are pumping out of that water table. But all of this depends on what material we're pumping from. And that material is highly variable around the state. We conduct aquifer tests to stress the system for short periods of time to see how it responds. That tells us how this material is going to react when we pump it under normal operations. So you pump that well on the right, if none of the other wells were happening and pumping and we monitored them, we'd see how the system responded. How did water move, in what direction, and how did everything react? You put all that into a computer model, and it can tell you then where's your impact of 1 CFS on the stream. How many millions or billions of gallons can we allow to be pumped here and not exceed our CFS flow limit? That's what we're doing right now for the Little Rock Creek area of the state. We're actively constructing that model. We recently completed the county geologic atlas in that area, so we're incorporating that new information into the construction of that model. We formed a technical advisory team of outside experts and consultants and other agencies to make sure that we're constructing it in a robust way. We've got an advisory team of the local irrigators and other appropriators and other local units of government there. They're going to be following along in the development of that. When that model is constructed, we should be able to use it to then run some scenarios of how is this pumping impacting the flow in the stream, and where are we at relative to this diversion limit? Where are we at in terms of do we need to make adjustments to permits or not? We don't know the answer to that question yet, but the model is supposed to get us there. So we're focusing on these intense use areas. This is another map before. The red areas really illustrate where we're using a lot more water within that area than other areas of the state. I've always said this doesn't say there is a problem, but we're using this to help us to focus where we think we need to start getting more information if we don't have good monitoring systems in place. So you got the North and East Metro there, we're investing. Dakota County's not highlighted with a boundary, but you see the vermilion, it's red. We've invested significant resources the last 2 years to enhance our understanding. We've conducted 4 aquifer tests. We've added some monitoring to the streams and some wells. Bonanza Valley, we've talked about many times in this committee over the years. More monitoring going in there. The Strait River up in Park Rapids, some of the other areas in that Pineland Sands geography, all the way down to Parker's Prairie, Clear Lake, and up through the Little Rock Creek area. Cold Spring would be on the very, very tip of that Bonanza Valley, southeastern tip of Bonanza Valley. So those are the areas we're focusing in. We're doing some work in the Pomme de Terre, which is in the upper watershed of the Minnesota River. That's where we're directing a lot of our resources, but we're also directing resources where we're getting well interference problems, some communities in southwestern Minnesota, Laverne, some other issues where we're doing aquifer tests and working with those communities. So as I conclude, I think you've all heard this. Amy can quote it. Compared to other states, you know, you hear about what's going on in California or Texas. They're in the emergency room. They're dealing with the impacts long after they've been initiated. We're in the urgency room. We've got some problem areas, but we've got some reasonable solutions. We've got a reasonable, well thought out process, and this is what we're doing to try to work through these. We think that we've got conceptually sound, good policies. The statutes are strong. You know, we've offered a few definitions here. We've offered the idea to combine some statutes, but we don't think we need to rewrite. I think there's a lot of good language there. We can pull it together and make it more clear, and that's the could-be-improved part. There is a strong scientific basis for setting of these thresholds. What we lack is locally specific information that we can apply that science to, but we can change that by collecting that data and investing in those kind of monitoring efforts over time. And for now, we're focusing our efforts on these intense areas, trying to help these communities work through these issues and make sure that their use is sustainable so that as they develop and invest in infrastructure, they can plan for it in the long haul. I have some extra slides on some other things that where the questions might go. I've got some climate stuff. I've got some roundtable feedback stuff, but maybe we want to get to any questions and then see where we're at, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Meckel. And, yeah, thank you. We do have, five people with questions. I'd like to take those five questions, and then I have Mr. Johnson from the League, Mr. Claven from the Irrigators Association, and Mr. Lincheski from Minnesota Trout Unlimited all want to speak for sure. So I want to allow all three of them the opportunity to speak. So thank you and thank the department for taking this issue serious. I think you've come up with some really significant recommendations that it would be nice for us to be able to pass in a bipartisan way some of the agency requests. I think whereas maybe some of us would like to see them go farther in either direction, I think you tried to put this in. And I do understand that we're in an important point here, but we're not in a crisis point. And thank you for your leadership in a tough issue. I've got Fabian Hansen, Hornstein, Purcell, and Cornish. Anybody else with a question at this point in time? Okay, we'll take those five folks, and then if any additional questions pop up from those five, we'll take those after the three testifiers. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, you've got the pages of recommendations and so forth here. The one recommendation that you have references statutes combining surface water and groundwater appropriation permits into that water appropriations. I guess my broad question is what is DNR's intention with regards to this session that we are in right now? It's a short session. There's a lot of things on the table, a lot of moving parts. Are you going to be proposing a bill, or where are we at?
Commissioner Meyer, I would direct people to slide page 13 is what Representative Fabian's referencing.
The bottom.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, as I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation, this is important work, and it's very complex and complicated. It's our intention at this point to reconvene the stakeholder group and engage the citizens of the state of Minnesota in this discussion over the interim and come back with a consensus package for next session that can be passed in a bipartisan fashion. So we need to take some more time with the recommendations and have more discussions, and that's what our intentions are over the interim.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen and I were part of a panel, and we talked about stakeholders at the Science Museum, and the stakeholders were viewed with some skepticism, but it wasn't me. I appreciate the fact that we're going to be involving the people who are going to be impacted by this. I am somewhat concerned about the possibility of rulemaking within the agency. going outside of the legislature to do some of these things. Can you tell me what your intentions are there?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, we will not have any rulemaking on the water appropriation piece. Some of the information we'll be providing you under separate cover will deal with the trout streams that was requested. We are looking at a package that would delist a number of trout streams throughout the state and also add additional waters. We need to do that, again, with the citizens and the stakeholders of Minnesota, working with Trout Unlimited and others and local communities and property owners to go through that process. That would be rulemaking, but as far as water appropriation pieces, we do not have any rulemaking plans at this point in time.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a word of caution, you know, obviously the issue, the grass strip issue that's been talked about for the past several months, you and I had a conversation in my office recently about, pardon the pun, but I think that some of the rhetoric has polluted the waters with regards to cleaning up some of the waters in the state of Minnesota. And I would strongly encourage the agency to send a message to the executive branch that if we're going to move forward on issues like this, we need to figure out a way to work together with people rather than pointing fingers and blaming people and using harsh rhetoric that really doesn't serve to solve a problem. If you're going to solve some problems, you're going to have to sit down with a cup of coffee and lean over the cabs of some pickup trucks and hoods and talk to people. And I strongly encourage you to take a different track than what has been done with some of the other issues that we faced. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always am reminded that the first step to solving a problem is to acknowledge that there is a problem. And I think the focus on that we've heard in the report today looks at quantity and didn't really address quality. And I think if you're going to take this on the road and get public input and public participation, it's important to look at the quality issues because the pumping could move contaminants. So in the dynamic system with more unpredictability that we have with climate change, if there's a pollution, whether it's used oil or salt or nitrates or pesticides, things that are able to move underground or in surface water, that cone of depression or that pumping can move that quality problem. And it would seem to me that private drinking water wells and public drinking water wells, where the water use is public consumption, you have to have some consideration of potential contaminants in terms of how we're managing water quantity. And did you look at that or will you look at that?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we did talk about water quality, and the statutes about groundwater appropriations in general do say that we have to consider water quality and dealing with contaminants and not moving contaminant plumes and those kinds of issues. And in terms of surface water impacts, the way we would consider that is if it's going to change the concentration of whatever chemicals might be in the groundwater, but also in the stream. When you reduce flow, you know, that you change, there's a dilution factor element to that. So those things need to be taken into consideration. But water quality flows typically are really quite a bit lower than the 10% threshold we're talking about. And so we discussed it quite a bit, and we think that our threshold isn't going to be a water quality stressor. I mean, there might be water quality stressors anyway, but we think that the threshold we've offered up is not going to compound the problem with a water quality stress, generally speaking. But each situation and location is going to have its own unique characteristics. I'm going to try to keep my answers short.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciated the map that you showed at the very beginning, and it seemed to correspond to areas of increased urbanization in terms of this focus on intense water use. And there was a study recently that the Twin Cities placed at the bottom third of 51 U.S. metro areas in efforts to combat urban sprawl. And so it seems to me that this increased urbanization is, of course, the cause and effect with the intensive use of groundwater. And I'm just wondering, it seems like you're treating a symptom of a larger problem here, which is land use and land use patterns. And interestingly, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo sounded the alarm on this. I think 10 years ago he did a bill asking the Met Council to study water use patterns in the region. So I'm wondering if you're having conversations or dealing with the Met Council on some of these issues, because even though water isn't considered a regional system, I think it should be. And so when you're, you know, looking at the future and addressing this issue, are you also looking at, you know, talking to them and talking about land use and the broader issues of sprawl?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, we worked very closely with the Met Council on the revision of the master water supply plan. We were part of a technical group that worked with them on some of the modeling they did. So, yes, we are working closely, and water supply plans are another area of responsibility that we as an agency have. Each community that serves more than 1,000 people has to develop a water supply plan and update that plan every 10 years. This year marks the beginning of the update cycle for communities around the state, so all of these communities, about 900 and some communities, will be developing new water supply plans over the next 3 years. We've been actively meeting with a number of those communities, sort of in phases. But I would offer that we're a water-rich state. It's not so much a question of do we have enough water, it's a question of how do we manage it. Which sources of supply do we go to? And our belief, and I'm not just talking the river versus groundwater, but reusing of stormwater off of parking lots, right? I mean, there are really innovative projects underway in this state that are blazing the path for what the future is going to hold in some way, shape, or form in terms of how we use water. Taking runoff from the road, running it through a constructed pond, and using that to irrigate the golf course instead of groundwater. You know, we frankly just didn't think that way in this state until the last 5, maybe 10 years at the most. But we're seeing the change. We see examples of that all over the place. And when I go out and talk about these in these communities, I hear these.
Representative Hornstein, any additional follow-up?
Well, no, thank you. So, I mean, but do you agree that increased urbanization is something that in some of these areas is an issue that we ought to be, you know, looking at and aware of and going into the future?
Mr. Meckel.
And land use patterns.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I won't comment on the urbanization aspect. I think it's just a matter of how are we meeting our water supply needs. You know, that's a secondary question to whether or not we're developing or not. Or, I mean, where we develop, yes, it makes a difference. It makes it harder to get water there in some cases. But
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell, then Cornish, and then we're going to take the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to build a little bit on what Representative Hornstein just mentioned. And haven't got to every word in here yet, and it's a good document. Thank you. But are there recommendations for water conservation? You just mentioned a number of them. I think there's a place for that in here. If it's not in here, I didn't see it. And another aspect that I didn't hear yet is along that line is how do we irrigate the agricultural crops? Are we, you know, doing the pivot sprayer? Are we doing drip? I mean, there's a huge difference in how much water is used depending on how you use it. So I look for some of that to be in here as well. I haven't seen it yet. Maybe it's there.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we didn't include those items in that document because this was focused on the thresholds report, but I'll just comment. All of the water supply plans that the cities will be working on include conservation measures as part of that and goals to reduce per capita consumption. Generally speaking, in the state, we are gaining, well, we're using less water per capita in some places, but in some it's going up. In terms of agricultural irrigation, I'll just be brief. Josh Stamper, University of Minnesota Extension, was hired a couple years ago now and has been really focused on working with the irrigation interests to figure out how to best and most efficiently use water. And he, you know, he's very actively engaged and he's working with a lot of instrumentation. And what he says is that, you know, we are, because of our central pivot systems, and many of them now go into the low pressure, variable rate, drop down systems, we are pretty efficient. Yes, there's more improvement. We, you know, and as we replace these systems over time, you replace them with the better ones. My understanding is drip, I don't know that that's going to be the solution in Minnesota, but our irrigators are on a path to irrigating more efficiently than some other parts. And we don't do flood irrigation as an example, okay?
like they still do out in California. So,
but Mr. Meckel, they are using drip in some of our other crops that we do in Minnesota, specifically vegetables,
right.
Have become big proponents of that because not only the water savings, but it helps them on some disease,
when I'm speaking,
disease issues, and they use it in the nursery business too, drip. Last question, Cornish, and then Mr. Johnson, why don't you go ahead and come down? I got you first.
Sir, how many currently actions have you taken or are in process, without giving names or farms, about making the farmers that irrigate pay for the wells? How many are, do you have any idea how many are finished or how many are in mitigation or in appeal process or...
Well interference, Mr. Meckel, I believe Representative Cornish is talking about when somebody's well is interfered potentially, and then do you have a quantity of number of well interference issues in the last couple of years?
I got one irrigator that I think so far that...
Representative Cornish.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, that he was threatened to pay, might have to pay for three wells, from one to three wells that have, neighboring wells that have gone down. You have any idea how many there are right now, cases going like that?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I don't have an exact number. There's usually what we see is around a half a dozen interference cases each year. Some of them we determine are not a valid interference. It was really a problem with the well itself, not because of a water level drawdown. There's a particular situation that's a complicated one. There's 11 irrigators involved, and I think two or three domestic wells that were affected, and that one's working through a process that, you know, they're, by law, they're supposed to negotiate and work this out. You know, we determine whether or not it's valid, then they got to figure out and make it work, and then we can then authorize them to continue to pump once they resolve the situation.
Follow up, Representative Cornish.
Just the only reason I bring that to light is a heck of a lot of money to replace the well. We want to make sure that the information is right that's getting to these people, because if a farmer has to pay for three neighboring wells, that's a big bill. We want to make sure that he or she actually caused it and how it's mitigated out. So,
in Representative Cornish, the department is working with the different interest groups, including ag irrigation folks, to look at an alternative model where maybe that you wouldn't need to exactly determine which farmer was the interference, but you determined there was interference, and then all the water appropriation permittees would, part of their permit costs, would pay that fund. We've not been able to reach a solution on that yet, but they continue to work on that. It might save some litigation costs and might make it more expedient process, but at this point, that has not been able to get resolved. Thank you. One final comment, Mr. Meckel, and then we'll go to the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick... A licensed well driller is required to go out and inspect the well that's been quote-unquote interfered with or that's having a problem. They file a report, and then we review that report. You know, was it a bad screen? Was it a pump? Did they just need to lower? There's lots of... Oftentimes, these things get resolved with minimal cost. But sometimes, it's a shallow well. Water table's drawn. The well driller says, it's not your well. It's not your pump. It's, you don't have water. And those are when it interferes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Hopefully, it's not a well driller from the area, because we've got the same problem in our county where we have people are making septic tank inspections that are the people are going to end up doing the work. So it behooves them to find something wrong with the septic system so they get work. So I'm hoping the well driller is from like 100 miles away.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meckel. We're going to let the testifiers. Thank you for the good presentation. No, you can move aside and take a deep breath. Grab a cup of coffee or a donut. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. And Mr. Clayton, why don't you come down, too, just to make it, and then we'll... after you two, then we'll do Mr. Lincheski. So looks like we've got enough time for 2-3 minutes of testimony from each of you, and then the same from Mr. Lincheski. And we may not have time for questions for you as testifiers, but if folks can approach you after the committee time. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate the chance to make a couple brief comments on this. Want to commend the DNR on the process they used on this. This is, as you've seen over the last few years, a very difficult issue, very contentious, with a lot of people both existing and potential future users of water resources who have a very significant stake in how this discussion goes. So it could have been a disastrous process, and I actually think it went very, very well. They had a very broad net they used to get everybody necessary at the table. They also had ample space for lots of people to be in the audience and to get their input as the process went on in the various ways that were available for doing that. And they made sure that they had their own leadership and expertise in the room so that we never had to wait for the next meeting to get answers on things that theoretically could have just been an answer we could get right then. They had the science people there the whole time. So it was very helpful. They also did make it flexible. We really felt we needed additional time, and they added a full day of additional meetings and extended a couple of the schedules to give us more time to chew on some of these things. Just briefly, as far as the recommendations go, we are very much in agreement that the case-by-case assessment of details is going to be necessary. Every situation is going to have significant differences about what other uses are happening in the area, the total use and the type of users, and the hydrology involved. So we know that's going to be necessary, and we're glad there's a recommendation of that. As far as putting any specific number to things, the recommendations suggest that perhaps a 10% use is where there is no detectable impacts. I think that the science supported that pretty clearly. 10% did have no detectable impacts. Our concern is that our task for this group was to come up with a definition of where is a negative impact on surface water, and 10% is where there is no impact on surface water that's detectable. So we actually think the number definitively could be a little bit higher than that. We do know the 20% number showed that there is an impact on surface water. So we think a more mid-range number, if a number is going to be used, would be more appropriate, keeping in mind that it would still have that case-by-case assessment of whether there needs to be summer water use restrictions or other peak water use or drought planning that needs to be a part of it to make sure that it's a sustainable water use for that area and that aquifer. Last thing I would just add, based on one question that was asked, is on water reuse. Stormwater water reuse is something a number of our cities are working very hard on right now. One of the more interesting challenges is we've collected this water. We're required to under federal law. We now have to deal with it in some way as a city. But to reuse it, we need to get a DNR water appropriation permit. And we're having a very difficult time with that in some cases. So we have our own regulatory process in the way of seeing some of the water conservation stuff that we're trying to encourage. We do think we're going to have to work on that in future sessions to get that barrier out of the way of doing some stuff to use water that otherwise is either going to have to be discarded into the system or not reused and just pumped up.
Thank you. Mr. Clavin.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Irrigators Association of Minnesota. We, too, were at the table, part of the process, and just echo Mr. Johnson's comments rather than reiterate them. We think the number should be higher for the same reasons as he reiterated. I was not personally at the meetings. We had our vice president attend, and he could not come this morning, so I'm kind of pinch-hitting here. I don't have much to add. Most of the points I was going to make have been covered. The trout stream discussion, Representative Fabian explored the history on the language, 2010, 2014 changes, and so forth. We supported the 2014 change going from potential to negative, because prior to that, anything could have had a potential impact, and that was kind of a lot of agency discretion. We supported the Howe approach last year on the number. It was 20% in the bill. We ended up with the stakeholder group and the conference committee. So as Mr. Meyer mentioned, we don't have consensus. We'll probably be back and keep talking with the department over the interim. I'll go off script just briefly on the questions that were raised. Representative Purcell is not here, but he was asking about the technology. Have things changed? And in the industry, they certainly have, to more efficient use, different kinds of irrigation, metering, and so forth. But we see that all over an ag. We see that with variable rate fertilizer spreading. We see that with micro rates on chemical applications. We see it with GPS and drone technology. And all that stuff is going on. We don't often get credit for that. We certainly get blamed, but we don't get credit for implementing those expensive technologies, and the irrigation area is one of those.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. Mr. Lincheski, why don't you come down? Thank you. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. If you're able to stick around for a few minutes in case any individual members had questions, let me know, or they'll let you know. Excuse me. Welcome, Mr. Lincheski. Identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Lancheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. I represent sportsmen and women around the state. We were a participant in that stakeholder process. It was a good process, and one of the things that was great about it was we had a great variety of participants. So it was great to be sitting down with the irrigators, the well drillers, the businesses, the municipal water supplies. It was a good process. We have our own thoughts on that. I think, overall, I guess I'll just back up. Trout fisheries, the scientists call them cold water fisheries. You really should probably call them groundwater fisheries. They're highly dependent on groundwater for that cold flow. They're a scarce resource. We're down to less, I think, maybe 6% of our streams, our trout streams. The trend has been downward. The state is trying to get a handle on that and prevent the loss of more of them. And just keep in mind, as of 3 years ago, the DNR never denied a water appropriation permit. Never happened. So it's only beginning, and there's a lot of concern on everybody's part that's understandable. I think there's a lot of frustration with the pace of groundwater model development, and that was probably a big takeaway from that process is that I think certainly Cold Spring and the businesses there, but I think everybody, that's a little frustration that the groundwater model development, it just takes a lot of time and resources, and I think we're all impatient to see that get done. So that would be sort of my big recommendation, is focus on how can we speed up the pace of the groundwater model development, because that's going to trigger all these standards. So quickly, the statute was sort of set a qualitative standard, don't want to have an impact on these fisheries. Then there's been some attempts to sort of quantify that. Well, let's pick a number and say you got to give up, 20% of the flow. I think you heard today why that won't work. Our concern is even with this threshold recommendation, it's still sort of a one-size-fits-all. Quite honestly, I think if you were to take 10% reduction in the base flow of a trout stream in August, it would have a negative impact. A warm water system, not so much. I mean, if a stream gets too warm, you kill all the trout. They don't magically reappear in that system. In a cold water system, they can migrate in from downstream where it's warmer. So that's the challenge here. I don't think any fixed number in statute about how much water you can pull out of a trout stream is gonna work. What the DNR is talking about is essentially guidance on how are they going to approach the information from their model. So we have our own concerns about the 10%. I think if we lock a number in statute, we're gonna have troubles. So we much prefer continuing the process, the dialogue with businesses, irrigators, well drillers. I think that was going well, and I think what we all want is certainty and an increased pace of developing these groundwater models. So,
thank you for participating, Mr. Lancheski. Representative Hornstein.
Just a very quick question, Mr. Chair, because I know we're wrapping up, but we had a little back and forth about trout streams earlier today, and has your organization been able to quantify like the economic impact, the tourism impact of protecting trout streams in the state? I think it's a big deal for a lot of Minnesotans. And do you have those numbers?
Yeah, we don't. Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have those numbers statewide. We know in just the southeastern part of the state, that area, I think it's been pegged at somewhere around $660 million a year is the economic impact. I will note that trout angling is the one area of angling that's growing. We have a concern in the state about reduced participation in hunting and fishing, and actually in the trout area, that's one bright spot in recruitment and retention of anglers. So it's a big economic driver.
Thank you, Mr. Lancheski. We're adjourned.
Thank you.